Good afternoon, good morning to everyone. Thanks for participating in the latest installment of our Current Issues in Derivatives webinars that we've been trying to hold on a quarterly basis for the last couple of years. For those who have participated in our prior webinars, and I know there are many of you, welcome back. And I'd ask your patience here while I take 30 seconds or so to go through some administrative matters. First, this webinar is being recorded, and it will be available for listening and viewing on our website within the next day or two after the webinar concludes. So if you need to leave early or if you have any colleagues or friends that may be interested, feel free to access this through the website later on. As a second matter, continuing legal education credit. This webinar is eligible for credit, we at a midway point or a little bit more than a midway point through the webinar, I will give you a CLE code, and then that code will be repeated again at the end. And then if you could, I think there are instructions in the email that you should have received this morning to access that will tell you to submit a code to my colleague, Lewis Marin, who's in charge of our CLE, and he'll make sure that you get the CLE credit for attending this. The last item on the administrative front is just, our operator Mike mentioned it, questions. We do encourage questions during the webinar, so feel free to submit them. If we have the opportunity to respond during the webinar, we will. Otherwise, we will respond after the webinar as soon as we're able. And there are several folks on here who have asked questions before, and you know that we'll respond to them afterwards. So that leads me into our session for today. Of course, today, yesterday we marked the 10-year anniversary of the signing of Dodd-Frank into law. So we think it's an appropriate time of year to just sort of think back on things like that. But we're going to talk about a few items here today. Our first topic is going to be on the recent guidance from the CFTC on civil monetary penalties. And my colleague, and I'll introduce him in a moment, Michael Loesch, is going to handle that. Then we're going to talk about commodity pools and traps for the unwary. This topic really comes out of some experiences we've been having lately where clients have come to us for advice, and it turns out that entities that you wouldn't think would have to consider issues on being financial end users and commodity pools and the like have had to wrestle through those issues, and we thought it might be worthwhile just to go through that topic here in this format for a broader audience. My colleagues Aaron Levy and John Ammons are going to handle that. Then we go into, we've got a little tradition here of talking about energy hedges because that's a big part of our practice, and Jason Lewis is going to talk about natural gas hedging and some structures that are out there. And then I'm going to wrap up at the end with just basically more of a reflection or looking back on Dodd-Frank in the last 10 years. So that's where we're headed today in terms of our topics, and will lead us into our first one. Again, Michael Loesch, a partner in our Washington, D.C. office. He's got a lot of experience with the CFTC and SEC both. And, Michael, I will pass it on to you.
Great. Thank you, Michael. My name is Michael Loesch. I'm in the Washington office of Winston & Strawn. And we're going to walk through some details regarding the recently issued civil monetary penalty guidance by the Enforcement Division of the CFTC. Next slide. Next slide, please. There we go. Before we jump into the details related to the guidance, I wanted to just put it in context and provide a little background regarding a recent trend at the CFTC. Since he took office, the current CFTC chairman, Heath Tarbert, has really consistently focused on transparency and the importance of transparency, and he's tried to bring that to life in a number of initiatives. And I think this penalty guidance ultimately is sort of the next step in that. But early on in his chairmanship, the CFTC adopted four core values. And one of those four core values is clarity, providing transparency to the market and market participants about the CFTC's rules and processes. So that's now a CFTC core value, you know, however far that goes, but it is sort of at least an important guidepost. In an open meeting, in remarks at an open meeting in December of last year, the chairman walked through a number of either goals or aspirations or concrete initiatives related to transparency. And, you know, in terms of regulation, that means more open meetings, more issues being taken up through a formal rulemaking process as opposed to interpretive guidance for no action relief. And a new policy to make public requests for no action and interpretive guidance. And then on the enforcement side, the CFTC has now published an updated enforcement manual. They've announced a policy to limit, to have fewer limitations on the ability of both the commission staff and then commissioners as well as market participants to discuss settlement terms. So transparency is a key part of what they're guided by now. Next slide. Again in that December 10 meeting, the chairman, you know, made a specific reference to enforcement, and this is a quote from those remarks: "We must be transparent in how we enforce the law. Deterrence requires clarity about how our laws work." So, you know, that was sort of, you know, an early statement that I think led to what we're going to get into detail about, which is the enforcement division's release in May of this year of new civil monetary penalty guidance. And that guidance outlines a number of factors that the division staff will consider when presenting to the commission for resolution of an enforcement action. This guidance, we'll go through some of the factors. It's fairly high level. It provides, you know, market participants in the industry with some more information regarding, you know, how the Division of Enforcement makes decisions regarding civil monetary penalties and enforcement cases. It's not all that new, but it is sort of an incremental step that is, you know, it does increase transparency somewhat. So next slide. So just a little bit of background on the CFTC's penalty authority. The CEA, the Commodity Exchange Act, authorizes civil monetary penalties for violations of the Act and for the CFTC's rules. It sets maximum penalty amounts per violations, and the penalties can be determined on a per violation basis or based on the triple of the monetary gain, whichever is greater. And the only sort of guidepost that's in the statute is in section 61, which requires that penalties be assessed in relation to the gravity of the violation. So that's sort of the statutory guidepost. Then in 1994, the Commission published some guidelines listing factors that influence its assessment of civil monetary penalties. These are still live and in place, and you should look at them. And these recent enforcement division guidelines do not supersede the 94 guidelines. They're sort of issued to provide more detail underneath them. Next slide. So that's the background and the history. Before we get into the detail, I wanted to put this chart up and talk a little bit about sort of, you know, what we're talking about here. And these are charts that you can find on the CFTC's website that lay out the penalty amounts that are in the Commodity Exchange Act. On the left in the first chart, it's for violations that do not involve manipulation or attempted manipulation. And the right-hand chart is for manipulation violations. And you can see in the column, the right-hand column, the columns that are outlined, the various amounts that are identified per violation. So for manipulation violations, it's for, you know, a regular person, it's 1.2 million, and it's the same amount if you're a registered entity. For an administrative action and for a non-manipulation, the amount currently is $168,000 for someone who's not registered with the commission, and it's close to $1 million for an entity or certain individuals that are registered with the commission. So this is if there's an investigation that results in a settlement negotiation where you're considering a penalty, these are some of the numbers that form the sort of the building blocks for determining a penalty. But it's on a per violation basis. So the question often becomes, what is a violation, right? In a manipulation case, is it every transaction? Is it every order that's placed? And depending on how you determine what is a violation, the numbers can get very high very quickly. And that determination is very much art and not science. And what is a violation or how that should be determined is not addressed in these new guidelines. So with that background, let's move on to the next slide. So the new guidance provides a framework that includes consideration of three major prongs that the division will consider in determining how much the penalty amount should be. The gravity of the violation, which again, that goes back to the statutory guidepost, mitigating and aggravating circumstances, and a category called other considerations. And it's important to know that this guidance is not it's not rigid, it's not formulaic, it's not like some other agencies where it's very much you plug in certain facts and a number pops out. It's very much principles-based. It sets out factors that are to be considered. And the guidance says that it should all be considered in the context of deterrence. And the CFTC's goal of specific and general deterrence. The object is to provide, of this guidance, is to provide clarity and to achieve, you know, more consistent and fair though tough results. The way the guidance refers to the overarching consideration of deterrence is sort of a catch-all. You know, no matter what these factors show, ultimately, you know, if the commission determines that a certain penalty amount is needed to serve specific deterrence for a particular actor, then you know that will and can override the particular factors. But let's get to the next slide. So here are the three prongs and the various factors underneath them. So with respect to gravity of the violation, it's what you would think. It's the nature and scope of the conduct, the state of mind of the parties at play, and the consequences flowing from the violations. Was there harm to particular individuals? Was there harm to the market as a whole? And what were those what were those harms? So that's the gravity of the violation. Under mitigating and aggravating circumstances, we're really talking about things that are done either before the conduct occurs or after the conduct occurs to remediate and to cooperate. So, after there was a violation, what happened? Was disciplinary action taken against the parties? Was it an isolated incident or did it involve more than one individual within a company? Is there a history of prior misconduct? Was there remediation of the compliance program? Was there a pre-existing compliance program that was reasonable and maintained appropriately? And was there cooperation with the investigation? And was the conduct self-reported to the commission? So those are the primary factors for mitigating and aggravating factors. And that's a really significant part of this guidance. The other considerations category is, what's the context of this particular conduct and how should it be viewed in light of the overall context? So, are there parallel investigations or settlements involving other regulators, the SEC, the SROs, DOJ? And then, what is similar conduct, resulted in prior cases? So what kind of monetary or other relief has been ordered in cases that look similar? And then the commission can always consider whether it in the conservation of its resources plays into, taking either a lower amount to make a case go away. So those are the key factors, and I encourage you to look at them, look at the policy, study it, because it's really important that you understand it, before you get into trouble, and not and not after you're already under investigation. So what are some practical considerations? You should know the penalty factors. You should look at these at the guidance, look at the factors, particularly the mitigating factors, and you should take mitigating actions now. You should look and say, is our compliance regime sufficient? Do we not have enough sufficient processes in place? Are we prepared to address misconduct when it comes to us? So take a look at these factors and consider what you can do now to be as well positioned as you can should misconduct occur. You should always, whenever misconduct or potential violations arise, should look at these factors and consider what steps you might want to take. You don't always need to take advantage of these mitigating factors, but you should look at them and carefully consider the pros and cons of remediation steps, of self-reporting, of cooperation, and make sure you're knowingly acting to either take advantage or not of the penalty guidance factors so that you can use that or be aware that it may be used against you when the investigation ends. And always consider the context. You need to look at the broader context and make sure that that is a factor in the consideration and your negotiations with the commission. You know, evaluate what's going on in other matters and in at other agencies and plug that in. So that's the quick rundown on these new enforcement division penalty factors and and the overall guidance. So happy to take questions at the end or any follow up later. But again, just take a look at these practical considerations and I encourage you all to review the guidance. Back to you, Michael.
Great, thanks, Michael. Much appreciated. That was very thorough and thoughtful presentation. So we're going to move on first, I guess, before moving to Aaron and John. Again, questions, anyone, feel free to submit them electronically. We'll see them real time here and try to respond. Okay, so for our next topic, I mentioned, we've had instances, several instances over the last couple of months of clients having to work through issues on being a commodity pool when they didn't even think that those issues were relevant. And within our shop here and on our team, Aaron and John have taken a lead role on this particular issue. So Aaron Levy is based in our New York office. John Ammons is based in our D.C. office. And maybe with that, I'll turn it over to our dynamic commodity pool duo.
Thanks, Michael. This is Aaron. Just to set the stage here, Michael already kind of mentioned some of this, but often this sort of issue kind of catches some end users off guard as they go through a bank's KYC process in order to execute a swap or other derivatives transaction. And since there are a range of implications that John will get into more in a bit, from possible registration requirements to clearing and margins, it's good to know in advance what to look out for in determining if your entity is a commodity pool. So I'm going to start by talking about what is meant by a commodity pool and the factors that go into determining if you are one, and John will then cover some of the implications and why you should care. So first, just want to pause at kind of a point of clarification here as far as terms we're going to use. I want to distinguish the term commodity pool, by which we mean generally the fund or other investment vehicle that executes the derivatives transaction or has exposure to it, from the so-called commodity pool operator, or CPO, by which we typically mean the sponsor, the manager of GP, et cetera, of the pool, which either registers with the CFTC or claims an exemption with respect to the pool. So with that, starting with the statutory text. The Commodity Exchange Act defines commodity pool as any investment trust, syndicate, or similar form of enterprise operated for the purpose of trading in commodity interests. That first part picks up funds and other investment vehicles when the assets of multiple investors are pooled, and more on that in a bit. But that last term, I just want to focus on that for a minute, commodity interests. So that broadly includes futures, options, and swaps, including on interest rates, commodities, and also certain FX trades, certain credit and equity derivatives. Notably, though, it does not include SEC-regulated security-based swaps, like a swap on a single security or a narrow index. It also does not cover certain excluded FX trades. A combination of Dodd-Frank changes to the definition of commodity interest, which added swaps, and a variety of CFTC staff interpretations over the years have really expanded the types of entities that constitute pools. So in the process, the statutory phrase for the purpose has largely been neutered, basically, given the CFTC's broad interpretation that even a single trade may be sufficient to render you a pool. There's also no exception for entities that trade solely for hedging purposes. So what does this all mean in practice? Turning to the next slide. if a private fund, a hedge fund, or a PE fund enters into a swap, that fund is going to be a pool. That's pretty clear. But even indirect exposure to derivatives can render a fund a pool. So if a fund invests in another fund or subsidiary pool where the subsidiary enters into a swap, both funds would be pools. And that applies in the context of a fund of funds or a master feeder structure where the master fund enters into a swap, both the master fund and each of the feeder funds would be separate pools. But on the other hand, if a fund owns a portfolio company, and that portfolio company is really a true operating company, you know, by which we mean it has employees or is actively engaged in a business, and only the operating company enters into a swap, that will not render either the operating company or the fund a pool. So where it gets trickier is in the context of derivatives entered into by a holding company subsidiary or an SPV below a fund that holds an asset or portfolio company. So looking at our little diagram here, so H1 and H2 in our slide in between the fund and the opco. So for instance, where a fund forms a holding company to acquire an asset or portfolio company, and the holding company borrows money in connection with the acquisition, it enters into a swap to hedge maybe the interest rate or the FX exposure. The question basically is whether the holding company itself is a pool and whether, you know, it renders the fund up above it a pool. And the analysis here can be highly fact specific, and so that's why people can be caught off guard. There are some rules of thumb, though. So one of the main ones is if a swap is entered into by a holding company and it's intended to really benefit the fund by, let's say, you know, providing investment exposure or hedging on behalf of the fund or evening out payment streams for the fund, the holding company and the fund are more likely in that scenario to be considered pools. And there are other rules of thumb too, but they don't really have time to cover all of them. But anyway, if a holding company is deemed a pool based on this kind of fact-intensive analysis, then the important thing to note is that the derivatives are attributed to the fund, rendering the fund itself a pool, as well as any intermediate holding company in the chain above the trading entity. So you can end up with a number of pools in a single structure. In our example, potentially each of H2, H1, and the fund. And that's significant since the operator of the pool, that CPO, will have to either register or claim an exemption with respect to each pool separately. And because the other requirements, margin cap, margin and clearing, that sort of thing, will apply on a pool-by-pool basis. Turning quickly to what is not a pool, so next slide. As noted, the term commodity pool does not pick up a portfolio company that's a true operating company. So X in our prior slide would not be a pool. Also, generally speaking, a single investor vehicle is not a commodity pool. Though if its manager or DP owns more than a de minimis equity interest in the fund, then, you know, it may be a pool, and that gets fact intensive there too. Another category of non-pools are entities that whose only derivatives exposure consists of derivatives that don't qualify as commodity interest. So this goes back to what we just mentioned about SEC regulated products and excluded FX, so-called physically settled FX forwards and swaps, where the two currencies are actually exchanged on a gross basis at settlement. And similarly, if you don't have any derivatives at the entity and no, you know, indirect exposure, then that entity is not going to be a pool, like we mentioned. And finally, there are also various entities for which the CFTC has granted relief from the commodity pool definition. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to get into a lot of those. I have those in the slides there. Briefly, you know, it kind of covers a range of instances over the years, from certain securitization vehicles to so-called equity REITs that primarily derive their income from managing real estate, and then certain vehicles formed by close family members, friends, business associates, et cetera. So I'm going to skip over, you know, some of the relief just in the interest of time. But one point just to note here at the end is, it's important to distinguish there are two types of relief. Sometimes you got relief from the commodity pool definition, but then there's also potentially relief or exemptions that are applicable to the CPO, to the operator. That's important because even where the operator is exempt from registration, the trading entity's status as a pool may still trigger certain regulatory requirements. And that I think is a good segue over to John, who's going to get into some of those consequences of being a pool. So, John?
Great. Hi. We can go to the next slide, too. Great. Perfect. Hi, I'm John Ammons, and as Aaron mentioned, I'm going to speak a little about what happens if your fund or other vehicle does qualify as a commodity pool. And first, as Aaron kind of touched on, whenever there's a commodity pool, some person or entity will also be classified as a commodity pool operator or a CPO. And CPOs must either register as such with the CFTC, which is actually done by a filing made with the NFA, the National Futures Association, or the CPO must satisfy an exemption from registration. And there are several exemptions, but the most common exemption from registration is the so-called de minimis exemption under Rule 4.13A3. And CPOs can rely on that exemption if they manage funds that, among other things, limit their commodity interest activities to be less than or equal to the fund's liquidation value. And even if a fund does have to register, in other words, it cannot avail itself of any of the registration exemptions, the CPO may be able to rely on an exemption from many of the regulatory requirements that are applicable to CPOs. And this is under CFTC Rule 4.7, and that is available to CPOs whose funds limit the investors to certain types of sophisticated investors called qualified eligible persons, or QEPs. The QEP, the list of entities and persons that qualify as QEPs is quite long, but qualified purchasers are one type of entity that is also a QEP. Next slide, please. But if a CPO does need to register and cannot rely on the Rule 4.7 exemption, the primary regulatory obligations are listed here. I'm not going to explain each of these obligations in depth due to time, but most importantly, the CPO must register with the CFTC, which is done through the NFA, and that is done using the Form 7R. Separately, the associated persons of the CPO, which are generally salespersons and their supervisors, must also register. And the principals of the CPO, which generally includes board members, executives, and persons or entities that own directly or indirectly more than 10% of the CPO, they must be identified and listed in the application process. And in each case, that's done through the Form 8R. Generally involves background checks and fingerprints as well. So associated persons must pass a proficiency exam. And this historically meant that APs must pass the Series 3 exam, but that only relates to futures. And so now there's a new proficiency exam for swaps, which is not mandatory yet, but will become mandatory in January 2021 for APs of commodity pools that engage in swaps. Also, CPOs must complete and file a number of reports to the CFTC, NFA, and the FEC if they are dual registrants. And the frequency and information that is included in those reports depends on the size of the funds that are managed by the CPO. But of note, the CFTC recently proposed to amend both the frequency and the content of the reports. And these reports, they are called Form CPO PQR, NFA Form PQR, and then Form PF, which is done filed with the FTC for dual registrants. And then there are a number of policies that are listed here that CPOs must adopt and implement. And also importantly, the NFA will periodically come in to examine each CPO. Next slide, please. Great. Aside from these regulatory obligations that are applicable to CPOs, there are also certain ancillary consequences of qualifying as a CPO. First listed here is the fact that the NFA's bylaw 1101 prohibits NFA members, such as CPOs, from conducting business with any non-members that are required to be registered. And this effectively requires CPOs to determine on an annual basis that their counterparties and investors satisfy these requirements, that they are either registered, exempt from registration, or not required to be registered. And bylaw 1101, by its terms, imposes strict liability, but the NFA has noted previously that it does not typically enforce the bylaw in that manner. Second, commodity pools are explicitly listed in the definition of a financial entity in the Commodity Exchange Act, and this has certain consequences as well. For example, financial entities are not eligible for the end user clearing exception, so commodity pools generally must clear any swaps that they enter into that are subject to mandatory clearing, which currently means certain interest rate swaps and index credit default swaps. Also, financial entities are not exempt from the CFTC's margin requirements for uncleared swaps. So commodity pools are subject to variation margin requirements, and they may be subject to initial margin requirements depending on the level of their swaps exposure. And further, being a financial entity could cause a commodity pool to automatically qualify as the reporting counterparty for swap data reporting requirements, if the other counterparty is not a swap dealer. And then finally, we would note that all swap market participants, anyone entering into a swap, must qualify as an eligible contract participant or an ECP, which is another form of sophistication standard. And there is a different test for qualifying as an ECP for commodity pools. It's specifically applicable to commodity pools. And so if you qualify as a commodity pool, you have to look to that test to determine if you're an ECP. And also of note, there's an even higher threshold for commodity pools that engage in certain types of leveraged or margin retail FX transactions. So that's the end of our CPO presentation. So I'll turn this back to Michael O'Brien.
Great. Thanks, John. Thanks, Aaron, for that presentation. So we're going to move into our next topic here on hedging structures for natural gas. Jason Lewis is a member of our team, a colleague who's based in our New York office. Most importantly, Jason has in his background a long history at working in at one of the major energy trading desks. So, Jason, with that, I will pass over to you.
Thanks very much, Michael. Just like Michael noted in the introduction to our program, We have spent quite a bit of time in our current issues and derivatives seminars talking about renewable energy hedges, but we are still seeing quite a bit of gas-fired project development and hedging that goes along with that, and that market is continuing to evolve in interesting ways, so we thought it would be worthwhile to spend some time on this topic. Next slide, please. So here's a list of the structures we're going to give a high-level overview of. But in general, I think it's worth noting that all of these are commercial strategies to lock in margin through either physically settled or financially settled transactions. And the structures that we're going to be considering today are some historical structures like PPAs and tolls, revenue puts, spark spread swaps, heat rate call options, and netbacks. Next slide, please. So just to put the discussion into historical context, traditionally, when doing a project financing, a sponsor would enter into a long-term fixed-price offtake agreement with a credit-worthy offtaker, historically a utility, and the sponsor would simultaneously enter into a long-term fixed-price gas supply and thereby lock in the margin between those. That structure is still the gold standard. It's desirable if it can be obtained, but it can, in this day and age, be difficult to find creditworthy long-term off-takers. And for that reason, the market has moved on to other structures. For example, tolls are also part of our historical context because they're currently disfavored, but under a toll, the tolling party, that's the party opposite to the sponsor, will pay a tolling fee, which also will include certain project costs like startup costs and variable operations and maintenance, and the tolling party will also bring gas to the facility as necessary to support its operations. The tolling fee paid by the tolling party is used to support payment of debt service by the sponsor, and the whole structure will allow the sponsor to focus on really the ownership and operation of the project. I think this structure was more popular at a time when organized electricity markets were first developing, and a lot of sponsors didn't want to take on the risk of participating in those markets. On the other hand, at that time, there were parties that did want the upside, and in return for that, they were willing to take outage risk and market risk related to the operations of the facility. Like I said, though, this structure is currently disfavored because I think the view of what that upside might entail has become a little bit more limited as the market has evolved. Next slide, please. So what's a sponsor to do without structures like PPAs and tolls? One thing that a lot of sponsors have done is enter into revenue puts. A revenue put is a financially settled option transaction. They've become, I think, more common in the northeastern electricity markets. So this is going to be documented typically on an is-the-master agreement with a schedule and a confirm. And under this structure, the hedge provider will sell an automatically exercised put option to the sponsor. What that means is that the sponsor is going to pay a premium, typically on a yearly basis, and every month, the hedge provider is going to calculate how much that facility should have earned given market conditions, but based on some assumptions about the generating facility itself. Then the hedge provider will compare that proxy amount to the actual amount of revenues that the generator earned during that period. And if the proxy level is higher than the actual, the option will be deemed to be exercised and the hedge provider will pay the difference. The purpose of that structure is to lock in a minimum level of revenues necessary to support debt service. For that reason, this is a structure that's favored by lenders to projects, but those premiums can be costly. Next slide, please. So another possible structure is the spark spread swap. Spark spread swaps are float-to-float derivative transactions, so they're typically documented on ISDA master agreements as well. Under this structure, the hedge provider will pay a floating rate based on a proxy heat rate for the facility, multiplied times a gas index plus a fixed amount representing the spark spread, multiplied times the applicable notional amount. Now, just to take a step back, a heat rate, for those who don't work in this industry, is a measure of how efficiently a generator converts gas to electricity. So a very efficient facility will have a low heat rate, but a very inefficient facility will have a very high heat rate. Also wanted to clarify, the spark spread is basically a difference between the cost of buying gas at a moment and the revenues to be earned by selling power at that moment. So that's what the hedge provider will pay under this structure. The sponsor, on the other hand, pays a floating rate based on a power index multiplied times the applicable notional amount. Since this is a typical swap transaction, that means in any calculation period, typically a month, but it can be quarterly as well, the party that pays the higher amount pays the difference to the other party. Now, separately from this transaction, the sponsor will sell power at a power index, typically the power index that's used in its floating rate formula, and it will buy power at a gas index, typically, or hopefully at least, the gas used in the hedge provider's floating rate formula. And when you stack all these revenue streams on top of one another, the end result is that the sponsor is receiving that spark spread per megawatt hour on a regular basis. And that locks in that amount of revenue for the sponsor. This structure can be said to incentivize efficient operations because the owner has the incentive to try to run its facility more efficiently than the heat rate. On the other hand, these transactions are typically not available for longer terms. They're more challenging to price because they're just swap transactions and don't include any premium. And for that reason, these are typically used post-financing and on a shorter-term basis. Next slide, please. So the next structure I wanted to talk about is the heat rate call option, also typically referred to as a HRCO. So in a heat rate call option, the sponsor will sell a call option to the hedge provider. What that means is that the hedge provider will pay a premium that provides revenue to support the sponsor's debt service on a regular basis. And the hedge provider can exercise its option on a regular basis within set parameters. For example, there's usually a time every day by which that option has to be exercised, and there can't be too many different non-contiguous periods in which those are exercised, and that's to mimic the fact that it's costly for a generator to turn on and off multiple times during a day. And when the hedge provider exercises, the hedge provider pays a price for power based on a gas index multiplied by the sum of a proxy heat rate plus variable O&M costs. The idea here is that the owner locks in revenue because that sponsor is going to receive a premium plus revenue from the sale of power. But on the other hand, that sponsor relinquishes some upside because in hours where the market price is high, the hedge provider would be expected to exercise, and the sponsor would be selling to the hedge provider instead of selling at a higher market price. Also in a HERCO, the sponsor still wears that basis risk, which can be significant. We also wanted to note a recent market development with regard to HERCOs. We have seen HERCOs that contain an auto-exercise feature that allows the hedge provider to go back retroactively at the end of the month and amend its exercise for certain hours in order to maximize its revenues. But that feature typically commands a larger premium to be paid to the sponsor. Next slide, please. So the last structure I wanted to talk about is the netback. The netback is a familiar term in the energy industry. It's long been used to refer to the profit that a party is making once you subtract its costs from its revenues. But that term is now being used to describe a structure for physical gas supply transactions where the price of gas is based on a power index. So a netback is a physical transaction. It would typically be documented on either an ISDA with a gas annex or an ASB. That's a standard form agreement used for physical natural gas trading. And in this structure, a gas producer, typically a producer at least, sells long-term gas supply to the sponsor with the price based on a set percentage of the applicable point where the generator is going to sell power. And the purpose of this structure is to mitigate cross-commodity risk. It's almost in a way like the flip side of a HERCO. So under a HERCO, the power price is based on gas. In a netback, the gas price is based on power. The idea is that the gas price is going to move in tandem with the power index used to price sales of power, and that's going to help the generator avoid negative spark spreads. A negative spark spread would mean that the price of gas, the main input to the generator, is higher than the price that the generator is actually receiving. That's a bad situation because, of course, it means that the generator will lose money. One caveat is that many of these netback transactions that have gotten done include caps and floors on the gas price, so they may not completely eliminate cross-commodity risk. This is an advantageous structure also because producers are able to transact for longer terms than hedge providers and often desire a long-term buyer. So in a way, everybody wins. Next slide, please. So I put together a comparison chart of all the structures we talked about. I'm not going to go back over all these. But in conclusion, I think what you see when you lay these all out together is that there really are advantages and disadvantages of every structure, and there's no one-size-fits-all solution. So for that reason, we really do encourage sponsors, lenders, hedge providers to think carefully about the structure they're entering into and whether it's optimal for that situation. Thanks very much. That's all for me.
Great, Jason. Thanks. Got one more topic before I get to it. CLE code is 07 0722. Again, 07222. I'll repeat it at the end as well. With the registration information you received in an email this morning, there's a form there to submit in to Lewis Marin here, who will get you the CLE certificate that you need. We'll also be doing a follow-up email tomorrow or within the next day or two, just with a summary of our webinar here today, and that will also have the form in it as well. So again, 07222. And our final topic here, as I mentioned at the beginning, everybody knows, right? Yesterday, Dodd-Frank turned 10, and we thought that we couldn't let this webinar pass with at least looking back a little bit on Dodd-Frank. I don't expect that I'm going to provide any new information. This is obviously a topic that's been discussed in great detail in a number of forums, including by ourselves, over the last 10 years, particularly as regulations were released and the like. But just looking back, what type of impact has Dodd-Frank had, and is it likely to stay, or will at some point will we be saying goodbye to it? The highlights, Dodd-Frank introduced mandatory clearing of swaps and security-based swaps. So we got now a distinction between swaps and security-based swaps. And it basically started as a presumption where entering into swaps will follow the futures model, will have to be cleared. So Dodd-Frank set up a whole new, we've got new lexicon now. We've got derivative clearing organizations. We've got swap execution facilities that govern the way in which swaps are cleared. But of course, not everything can be cleared. We didn't lose our off-exchange market completely here. So we've got, the clearing requirements. There has to be a clearing determination at first. To date, really, there have only been a limited number of clearing determinations made by the CFTC. So certain types of interest rate swaps and certain types of credit default swaps have been determined to be clearable. But right now, there are anything else, is not subject to mandatory clearing. Now, the clearing determinations did pick up, good chunks of the swap market. It also, I'd venture to say, this is my own personal view, it wasn't really quite transformative as people feared, because if you go back just prior to Dodd-Frank, you'll find that the market was moving to clear these types of swaps anyway. So I'd posit, at least while it gave Dodd-Frank gave a nudge to sort of completing that process, it didn't really transform the market in that sense. And, of course, as part of this process, we've got exemptions to clearing, a good number of them, but including the end-user exception that's available for, the ordinary hedging and mitigating exposure activities of, end-users. Dodd-Frank also brought with it registration of swap dealers, including, capital requirements for the dealers and the like, and business conduct rules. And I think everybody on this call, anytime they're thinking about a swap, encounters the business conduct rules when they're asked to provide enhanced know your customer information to your swap dealer that you're talking about. And you have to consider, do we do that on a protocol that ISDA's put out, or do we do it on a bilateral agreement? It's all a result of the business conduct rules that were brought into force under Dodd-Frank. Reporting and record-keeping requirements. Again, everybody on this call, if you're thinking about entering the swap, you got to make sure that you've got, a GMEI, a market entity identifier, or what was formerly known as an LEI. Because the trade that you're going to enter into is going to be reported to a swap data repository. And information in a swap data repository is not available on an individual basis to the public, but it's available on an aggregate basis. And so you find there's a weekly swap report that the CFTC puts out that talks about notional amounts of different types of swaps that have been entered into in the past week, you know, in the reporting period. Same thing, cleared margin, you know, how much margin has been posted in the reporting period. These are all new, and it's all comes out of a desire, a fundamental principle in Dodd-Frank to try to make the market more transparent. Another issue that we're living with now are margin for uncleared swaps. So even if you don't have to clear for a good year and a half or so, unless you've got an exemption, you've had to post variation margin. There are the exemptions for the typical end user. You're not subject to this, but for any type of financial end user, money funds, et cetera, the commodity pools that Aaron and John talked about, you're looking at having to post variation margin. Similarly, there's initial margin requirements. Now, those were phased in, and the largest dealers now are well into having to had to implement requirements to post and collect initial margin. There are so-called phases 5 and 6, which I'll mention in a second, that remain to sort of be implemented. Dodd-Frank also brought with it the concept of a SIFI, or systemically important financial institution, and orderly liquidation process for a bankruptcy, basically, of a SIFI. And that's for the end user now. If you're dealing with one of those institutions, you'll have had to encounter the resolution stay protocol. And again, do you need to adhere to the ISDA protocol on that, or do you negotiate that bilaterally? Now, I will note the concept of a SIFI got rolled back a little bit back in May of 2018, so that some of the smaller banks, regional banks that had been swept up in that concept were sort of relieved of the obligations of and the burdens of what it means to be a SIFI. But fundamentally, for the largest institutions, those remain the same. We're 10 years into this, but, you know, we still have things, still have parts of the mandate in the statute that remain to be implemented. I mentioned for initial margin, we've now, as of last week, I think we've had a subsequent extension because of the COVID situation that the CFTC adopted, but we have so-called phase 5, which picks up covered swap entities, or, you know, swap banks, basically, that have an average daily notional amount of trades outstanding between 750 billion. That's now been pushed out to September 1 of 2021. It had been up until April, I think it was, September 1 of 2020. So that's been pushed out a year. And then correspondingly for the group that falls in the 8 to 50 billion in aggregate daily notional amounts, compliance phase has been pushed out as of last week to September 1 of 2022. So that's still, you know, in the process of being implemented. Position limits, probably the biggest area that still remains to be implemented. There's been a couple of attempts at this. The most recent was earlier this year, a reproposal of the rule. The comment period closed on that. Michael or John can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think sometime in May or so, roughly that time frame. So those rules, the comment period's ended, but I think we're all internally here in our conversations, we're a little bit skeptical about whether the rules will be finalized prior to the election. So we'll see what happens there. I talked about clearing. Yeah, I mean, what about, you know, other clearing determinations? You know, always the question, when is FX, foreign exchange, or particularly non-deliverable forwards, you know, are those going to be subject to clearing? And there's been a lot of talk from time to time about that. But still to date, no clearing determination on that and no real indication other than just sort of passing conversations as to any timetable for that. So, again, don't expect that anyway in the near term. And then finally, security-based swaps. We've had, Dodd-Frank has been sort of a tale of two regulators, right? The CFTC came out of the gate very quickly, put in place a lot of the implementing rules and regulations, particularly a number of years ago under Chairman Gensler's guidance. There, the Securities and Exchange Commission, which has jurisdiction over the security-based swaps, has been much more deliberate in its process, and in fact, most of the rules, the implementing rules, weren't announced until last end of last year, and aren't even scheduled to go into effect until 2021. So, dealer registration, security-based swap dealer registration requirements and like won't come into effect yet until 2021. One thing I thought I would mention is just looking back on, we've got all these rules and regulations now in Dodd-Frank, what are more important areas? And I think you can tell that by where the CFTC has focused its enforcement activities. And the majority, I think even maybe a supermajority of actions on the enforcement front under Dodd-Frank come up in the context of dealer reporting violations or record-keeping violations. So the focus has really been on sort of the transparency of the market aspect of Dodd-Frank. A recent example, just to give you a little context here, back in mid-June, Deutsche Bank entered into a consent order that stemmed out of, there's a bit of history here. The bottom line was there was a $9 million civil fine that it had to pay, and then it's got a permanent injunction from violations, really all stemming from violations of the Dodd-Frank reporting rules that are imposed on dealers. This really sort of resulted in two stages. Back in, if I remember right, the 2015 time frame, Deutsche Bank had some issues where their systems were not reporting cancellations of swap agreements. And the CFTC came in at that point in time, really came down on Deutsche Bank. There was a consent order at the time. There was a monitor appointed to try to correct, the issues that Deutsche Bank had with their systems. That was all sort of taken care of. The monitor left. And then, it's just one of those things. Back in spring, I think, of 2016, they were going through an upgrade on their electronic platform, and they had to shift data to a backup platform. In the process of doing that, they ended up corrupting their files. The upgrade went bad. They went 6 days, I think, without reporting any data. And then when they got back up online, they had continuing problems in reporting. And the SEC came in and basically looked systemically and said that their systems weren't set up properly, they weren't maintained properly, and all of that. And that's what led to the most recent consent order. So, again, the focus seems to be on the reporting aspects here. With that, I guess I'll finish up, just in terms of, it's hard to predict the future, but, I'd say at least the reporting elements of Dodd-Frank are here to stay. Who knows what the election will bring, but if there are areas for maybe rollbacks, I could see it in, maybe some of the margin rules, because there's some smaller entities are being picked up, I think, inadvertently in those rules. Securitization vehicles are subject to the rules, which impede some of the securitizations and the like. So with that, I will conclude. Again, our CLE code 07222. And I want to thank everyone for taking time out of their schedules to share this time with us. We do these on a quarterly basis, so look for another one of these webinars in, sort of the mid-fall range. And as always, contact any of us We've got our contact details here, and you know, with any questions, follow up on this, and I'll conclude and say have a great day and stay healthy. Thanks, everyone. Bye.